This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I've been asked by the two teachers to talk a little bit this morning to kind of begin their teachings about the precepts. And of course, the kind of wrap up, the finishing will be the precept ceremony on Sunday. This is a kind of straightforward trajectory toward receiving the precepts. By the way, Kōbun Chino Otagawa Roshi emphatically said, you do not get the precepts, you do not take the precepts, you receive the precepts. Very important distinction. The precepts are not an acquisition. They're not something separate from yourself. They're something you already have. And you're actually receiving, which is, you could say, your birthright, what you already have. So these two problematic teachers talked me into talking a little bit start the ball rolling about what this session is about, what the precepts are about. Maybe a little background is in order right now. So let's all go back. Let's all go back. And some of us know this kind of origin story of the Buddha way. This person, Siddhartha Gautama, had a problem to solve. He had a problem. He had a question about the brightness of life. About backgrounds. Speaking. He had a problem about what we call dukkha, or dissatisfaction, about the unhappiness of life. And he went out and he solved that problem through practices and austerities. And after he, let's call it, after he became thoroughly happy, after he became thoroughly complete or fulfilled, he was not inclined, or he did not think he was able to share his experience with others. But as he moved out into the world, he noticed, by contrast, you could say, that other people were unhappy, other people were unfulfilled, that suffering still existed for those people. And so he went about the activity of sharing his experience. And in the sharing of his experience, the thought came back to him that he would return to these five friends of his who practiced austerity practices with him. And he would go back and share his experience with him. And he went back and he shared his experience of, let's call it fulfillment or completion. And although they were first reluctant to receive him, they heard his teachings. And one of them, Kanadaya was his name. It said, Kayadana caught on. Kayadana caught it. And the Buddha said at that point, Ehe Bhikkhu. Ehe Bhikkhu. This translates as, come, monk. Come forward, monk. Come forward, practitioner. Come forward into the holy life. Come forward into the life of intention. Come forward into the life of reality, of seeing things as they are. Come forward. That was the first ordination. Just those words. No precepts. No ceremony. Just come, 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 come and do what I do. Come and practice with me. Come and meet me. That's it. That was the first ordination. And the other five joined him, and others joined him as well. There was a rich merchant's son named Yasa who came and joined, and many of his friends joined as well, and started to become the Sangha. And even Yasa brought his mother and her sister, and they became disciples of the Buddha, one of the first disciples of the Buddha. And there were bhikkhus, those bhikkhunis, who actually left householder life, in other words, became specialists, you could say, became fully ordained. And then there were those who were lay practitioners who actually practiced as well, but supported the practice as well, both men and women. And it was egalitarian. It was totally egalitarian. So there were aristocrats, and it was a very stratified society at that time. There were merchants, there were just workers, and everyone in the Sangha was equal. Everyone in the Sangha was equal. It was totally equal. Anyway, that's a little bit of the background of ordination. And later, the term Visraya, which means a home living, came into being, and there was the kind of understanding of how the community lives together and how they live ethically together came into being. So this whole thing grew rather organically. The early term for ordination was called Upasampada, ordination. And what it involved was what's called Sarana. And Sarana means refuge. You take refuge in your own awakened potential or your own awakened being, which is called taking refuge in Buddha, the Buddha way. You take refuge in Dharma, which is your own ocean, vast ocean, bigger than you know, of wisdom and understanding. You take refuge in that, and you take refuge in Sangha, which is this interconnection and involvement that you have with all beings and all things. So that was the original teachings, this Trisarana, this refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And those of you that are about to take the precepts will be taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the way Koban Chinaroshi translates this word refuge, it's very interesting. We sometimes, when we hear the word refuge, we think of it as a place to hide, a place of protection, a place, almost a place to pull back, a place where we're not harmed. But the actual
etymology.
I don't want to call it an insect. Etymology.
Not enta.
Etymology. Of the word is re, Latin is re fuge. Fuge means to fly. And re, of course, means to fly back. So the term refuge means to fly back. To fly back where? Fly back home. Fly back to our true selves. To fly back to our, you could say, our source. To fly back to our ultimate request of life, which is to be fulfilled, to be real, to be complete, to be a Buddha. So Koban calls, instead of saying, I take refuge in Buddha, he translates it, I return to Buddha. I return to Dharma. I return to Sangha. I return. You fly back home. You remember. You remember your original pure, undefiled way. You remember your original self. And that original self is the source of this request to receive the precepts. To actually, at this point, to say, yes, I will. I will meet this situation with deliberation, with intention. I will actually say yes. So in the Zen tradition, we sometimes use this kind of, it's kind of a snappy little statement. We say, first clean, then sit. First you clean, then you sit. In other words, like, it's fine if you want to meditate and you want to have a holy life, but you've got to provide a wholesome situation, a kind of workable ground for you to actually do this work. And it's work. Believe me, meditation, as you know, is not just hanging out and getting a little bliss hit. It's work. It's work. You have to meet yourself at the crossroads all the time, body and mind. It's work. So in order to do this work, you need to have a good, wholesome base. A good, wholesome base is to have a good, wholesome life. To have a good, wholesome life is to have a good ethical stand. To have a good ethical stand, you have to receive the precepts. You have to be the precepts. You have to embody the precepts. So this is the place where we are. We say, yes, I'm ready to be an adult. I'm ready to grow up. I'm ready to meet the the karmic conditioning of my life and the causal conditions of my actions. I'm ready to be responsible. I'm ready to meet life. I don't know about you, but a lot of my delusional life might be compared to believing that I lived in a room that had a door that I could close, like a hotel room with a locked door. And I still fall into that place of fear and protection and that small mind sometimes. But the fact of the matter is we don't live in locked rooms. Unfortunately, we live in a hotel lobby. And the whole world is meeting you and walking right through you. And you're walking right through everyone else's hotel lobby too. So the hard truth is we're totally involved with everyone else and with the plants and the animals and with this cup of water. So it's time for us to be adults, to lead a comprehensive life. The threefold practice of the Buddha is comprehensive, like it's your whole life. So it's not just wisdom, it's not just dharma or prajna. That's one part of it. It's not just meditation, but it's also ethics. Those three are the threefold practice of the Buddha way. It's comprehensive, it's your whole life. So those of you that are entering the Buddha way, I salute you for meeting yourselves this way. And maybe these other teachers here would like to say something about
Thank you, Shahan. You took part of my talk for tomorrow. We've not discussed this, but you did. I'm just telling you, I don't know how he does this. I'm way over there. And I can prove it because I talked to a couple of people in Bogusman, so I've got the evidence. I've been thinking and reflecting, and it's what Shoharoshi was speaking about is taking refuge. And a little bit of the precepts I was thinking in my sleep last night, that if we could just distill them, we could just say, we take refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha took refuge in the Buddha. He wasn't worshiping himself. He was worshiping this really hard. this expansive, interconnected, eternal, untouchable, ungraspable, ungrabbable, everything, everywhere, all the time, as the movie goes. And that's you, each of you, a Buddha. And this is your chance to say, yeah, I admit it. I'm willing to say yes to this Buddha, to all the Buddhas that you encounter, from the cup to the birds to these bodies. Yes, 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 yes. This big open heart. Not knowing what you're encountering and experiencing it. That's there. Together. So we're very happy, all of us who took that big leap that you're about to take. And it takes courage to admit to yourself, yeah, I'm ready to grow up, as Shoho says, to take full responsibility for this beautiful catastrophe that we're in together. And we are very grateful for your practice.
And that was my talk.
Calm down, you're all in the lobby.
Is there a late checkout? I can't think of, and I haven't found a better way to have a good relationship with myself, people around me, the places that I get to call home. Being able to receive the precepts. It's also being able to transmit the precepts. It's being able to actualize the precepts in our lives. And as Shoho Roshi said, we have to kind of get correct with ourselves too. We have to look at ourselves clearly. And when we lead a good and wholesome life, right? The practice feels like it's flowing from us a lot more. Things get easier. Even when they get harder. That's why I practice. I think about the precept talk I saw at Zenke Blanche Hartman at the San Francisco Zen Center. She was the first female abbot over there. And a really, really great model of practice. And she said the precepts are like a signpost on a frozen lake. Each precept tells us where the ice is thin. It's not a dictate on your behavior, it's not a limit on your life. It shows you where you need to show up, where you need to be careful, where you need to act skillfully. Because the ice is thin. So if you're lucky, you don't have to skate. You don't have to ice skate in any of these spots. Yeah. But Not all of us are always so lucky. And some of us can really embrace a really kind of skillful action and help others navigate this icy lake. By doing that, by living a good life in harmony with myself and with the people around me and the places I live, precepts kind of keep themselves. If I'm in relationship with all of those beings around me and inside me, the precepts,
then it isn't a rule. It's a natural expression of your life going forward, something like that.
Absolutely. At least I'm trying.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to. I'm glad we're trying.
I'm happy you let me try here. I'm so happy you're trying with me.
Something about the precepts is we, in this tradition, we emphasize a kind of connection to the original teachings and the original teachers. So we have a what's called a lineage thread. And so from the beginning of this process, when the Buddha said, come monk, first ordination. And then it kind of grew into a kind of rules about how to live and how to be wholesome. It got passed from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student. So besides receiving these precepts from your two respective teachers, you're going to be receiving the precepts from everyone who's behind them. So I'm a preceptor to these two people here. They also had preceptors besides myself, but I'm one of the preceptors. Behind me is Colvin. Behind Colvin is a whole line of people that go back through Japan to Keizan, Dogen Zenji, through China, through India, to the Shakyamuni Buddha. You can almost feel as the precepts are being conveyed to you from these two teachers, giving these precepts, you can almost feel like a whole lineage kind of pushing on their back, pushing them forward to meet you. It's almost like they themselves are like a, you know how a funnel is? It's got a point, right? Then the little point and it drips up. Like they themselves conveying the precepts to you are like the forward point of the funnel. And all the lineage, all the people that are practicing, all the people that have maintained this way are kind of pushing on their back and pushing the precepts out through them to you. And you, in turn, who knows? You may be pushing the precepts out to someone else in turn, because this way, I predict, will continue. And it may continue through through you as well. Would anyone like to share anything or have a question? Or say, what am I doing here?
That would be a good question. I wonder if any of the students who are receiving the precepts would like to talk about, share how it is right now here. Couple of days in advance of this, stepping across this threshold. Anybody have anything awful? You're not wrong, whatever you say.
I have a question for Mike. This lineage, my suspicion is doesn't even start with Buddha himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's, when we chant, we say the seven Buddhas before Buddha. And there's a sense of before Buddhism, before the idea of an individual, one individual waking up, that there's a whole progression of people waking up this way. And what I like about that story is not that it's necessarily connected to the lineage, but that it's not. So that there's, besides what we might call those Buddhists that are in the Buddha way, there are natural Buddhas or spontaneous Buddhas or Buddhas that wake up without, or you could say are fulfilled without any, tradition or any story like that. Yeah, that good point. That's a really good point. Yeah, the seven Buddhas before Buddha. So when we chant, we always remember that. It's kind of like saying, yeah, we got a good thing going here, but there's outside the system, it still works, so to speak. Yeah, because we don't know. You know, there's no.
We don't have the corner.
Yeah, don't have the corner on it. That's a good way to put it.
Like Pratitya Buddhas,
huh?
Pratitya Buddhas.
Pratitya Buddhas, yeah. Pratitya Buddhas, yeah.
That's a hard one to say.
Yeah.
How am I going to spell? How am I going to spell? I wonder if you could say something about other ancestors. I was thinking about my grandmother this morning. She had a lot of wisdom for me. I wonder if you could say something about that.
Sounds like a Pratitya Buddha.
Indeed.
Yes, I think when we remember our ancestors, our blood ancestors, we should keep them in mind that they're also part of our lineage. Is that what you mean? Yeah. And our family members that exist right now, our sons and our daughters, grandmothers are important, aren't they? I would consider a primary teacher to me. Yeah, she taught me to have a sense of joy of life.
And maybe also clean up before you sit.
Hmm?
Maybe also clean up before you sit.
Yes, and behave yourself, yeah. If you really want to learn the precepts, talk to your grandmother.
If you really want to be challenged with the precepts, have children.
For every football game that you watch, for every World Series that you watch, for every World Cup that you watch, there's thousands of millions of people in the bleachers, right? So where they all come from? It came from their mothers. So respect to the mothers and the grandmothers. So I have this.
That's followed to our mothers.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you, for the people who are new to Jokoji, if you talk a little bit about the lineage that's on the wall up there, Kodo Sawaki, and the community room. Mm. They don't know Kodo, they don't know Keibun.
Kobunchino Roshi came from a kind of aristocratic, very old, established Soto family in Japan, in the north western Japan, western Honshu, and his family had for many generations maintained a temple, and when he was after World War II, in Kyoto, he went to study at the university and practice with Koto Suwaki. So he had a strong connection with Koto Suwaki. So it's Koto Suwaki's up there, I take it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He studied at Eiheiji Monastery in Japan, and in 1968, Kobun was unusual because the family he was adopted into to take over another temple in his town, the Chino. Was also his high school English teacher, and so he's very adept in English. And so in the monastery, he was one of the few people that could speak English, and he accommodated a lot of the first students that Suzuki Roshi sent over to practice after Suzuki Roshi established kind of one of the first beginning sanghas in America, Soto sanghas, Soto Zen sanghas, and so since Kobun was kind of the point person and knew English, he and Katagiri were the two people. Katagiri was another person that was studying English, was asked to come and help Suzuki Roshi with this kind of new American sangha, these new American, these barbarians in America needed some help. So so Suzuki needed some help. So Kobun came over and to America, 68, I think, and he landed in San Francisco. You can imagine 1968, about two blocks away from Haight-Ashbury. So it was like, talk about a culture shock. Coming from this protected monastery place into this wild hippie scene. It's must have been quite an experience. And then Kobun helped set up Tassajara. And later set up a sangha. He was invited to come to what was called Haiku Zendo, which was down in Los Altos, which is just down the hill there. And that's where the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind was made with Suzuki Roshi. So that small little sangha invited Koban to come, and he lived there for a while and raised a family and also set up Tassajara and helped set up the monastic forms in Tassajara. And then later, Santa Cruz Zen Center, Spring Mountain, Canando were created. And when Canando, and that's the core of that was called Bodhi. It was an organization. Bodhi bought Jikoji, and that Jikoji, that's the creation of Jikoji. Jikoji became this country meditation place. And there are other temples or practice places in New Mexico and in Europe and now in other places as well. But that's how Koban sort of came to the West, you could say, you know. Well, this Bodhidharma came to the West. Yeah. I answer your question. Yeah. And so here we are at Jikoji, and this is a temple founded by Koban Shinroshi and for 30, 40, 50 years. 50 years. We've been about 50 years. We've been maintaining this temple as one of the base temples of the lineage of Koban Shinroshi. And here, in a few days, there's going to be quite a special ceremony. I mean, receiving the precepts is a big deal. It's a very big deal. It's not, you know, it's not a small thing, receiving the precepts, which means that the Buddha way is doing well here and now in this place at this time. We're all part of it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.